Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Giant telescopes and artificial gravity. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. It may sound like science fiction, but engineers are developing a space station capable of artificial gravity. Commercial company Vast wants to put private space stations in orbit, and providing some sort of gravity is key to that plan. We'll hear from Garrett Reisman, a veteran NASA astronaut and now an advisor at Vast, about the need for gravity when living and working in space. Then, a new ground-based telescope so large it may one day snap an image of a planet outside our own solar system. We'll hear from Rebecca Bernstein, chief scientist for the Giant Magellan Telescope, about those efforts. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? A handful of companies are developing plans to launch commercial space stations into orbit. That means more opportunities for people to live and work in space. With that comes some physiological risk. The microgravity environment of space leads to muscle and bone density loss and changes to spacegoers' eyesight and other neurological issues. The company Vast is working to mitigate those risks by designing a commercial space station capable of artificial gravity. Here to talk more about the plan is Garrett Reisman, a veteran NASA astronaut who spent 107 days in space. He's now an advisor at Vast and joins us now.
Well, let's talk about Vast, Garrett. You've recently joined as an advisor for the Human Spaceflight Program. Tell me a bit about Vast's ambitions and what we can expect in the future from this company.
Yeah, well, I was approached by the leadership of the company, and it's immediately sounded very interesting to me. So this is a company intent on making private space stations, and in particular, private space stations that employ artificial gravity, which to me was a very important, very intriguing attribute to their space station, and it really makes this company kind of stand out from the other companies out there that are trying to make private space stations. Their goal is to kind of start small with this Haven 1 space station and then move on from there to much larger space stations. And really, there's no limit to the ambitions. Eventually, they want to have space stations really throughout the solar system. So it's a really exciting company, and it's a really exciting project.
Garrett, you mentioned artificial gravity and why that was important to you with this company. But isn't the fact that there is no gravity or microgravity in space half the fun of it? I've seen videos of you in space. It seems like a great time. Why is it so important that you negate that kind of effect when in orbit?
Well, it is fun. I remember having a conversation from orbit with Ron Moore, who created Battlestar Galactica and then For All Mankind, which is a TV show I'm working on now. And I asked him, like, you know, I watch your show and all these people are walking around Galactica and they're in one gravity. You have this, you know, magical gravity thing, generator somehow. And why would you deprive them of one of the best things about being up here, which is floating around in zero G, you know, and all the fun we have? And he said, Garrett, do you know how expensive it is to do all those special effects? And as fun as zero G is, there are some, frankly, negative physiological consequences. Many people listening to the program know about the bone loss that occurs, the atrophy in a lot of our muscles that occur when you're in the microgravity environment for extended periods of time. But maybe not everybody knows that also we have problems where just recently discovered where we're losing our visual acuity. So our eyesight is deteriorating because we're in this environment. And not only that, but recently we found out that you can even have problems with your blood flow through your jugular vein. It can stagnate or even flow in reverse and cause a thrombosis, which is like a blood clot that could be a life-threatening situation. So there are some serious negative consequences of living in zero gravity that we haven't completely figured out yet. And what we don't know, which is really interesting, is does all this stuff go away if you have just a little bit of gravity? Now, maybe that's all you need. Maybe you don't have to be in Earth's gravity. Maybe lunar gravity is good enough. But we have no idea because we have no data. We have data at 0G, and we have data, you know, billions of data points at 1G at Earth's gravity. But we have nothing in between. So space stations that can simulate artificial gravity. And the nice thing about VAST design is that, yes, at the end of the spaceship, at the tip of what we call the stick that rotates this 100-meter space station, at the tip, you'll be at 1G equivalent to Earth's gravity. But as you move along the longitudinal axis of the space station, you get lower and lower gravity levels until in the center, there is zero. So if you want to, you know, play with your food and have fun, you can still do that, right? You can still have the joy of it. But as you move, but if you want to live in lunar gravity, if you want to live at Martian gravity, you can do that just by moving up and down the length of the stick. And that's a really neat capability, especially from a scientific perspective.
This is tough for me to admit to my listeners, is I have not finished Battlestar Galactica yet. I'm on season two. and I don't think they have mentioned how they have done it yet. But, you know, when you watch science fiction, right, it's a switch, you know, that, you know, they've got some sort of technology that does this. But in the real world, this is the stuff that you and VAST are working on. How do you actually simulate gravity from low Earth orbit? I assume it's not a switch or some sort of Star Trek technology you all have discovered at this point. How does it work?
It would be great if we had the ability to control gravity like they do in those movies. But and people think at NASA we have like zero gravity rooms where we could like go in and float on the Earth, you know. And the truth is the only way to do that and create artificial gravity is by substituting for gravity, you know, basically motion, by spinning. So, and a lot of people have experienced this. If you've gotten into an amusement park ride where you spin around in a circle and you're flung outward, that centrifugal force is this pseudo force that you're feeling, and you can take advantage of that in space to create what feels like gravity. So if this has been depicted in science fiction as well, probably most notably in 2001 with a giant wheel that was spinning, and this was proposed a long time ago to create these massive spinning space stations that would be able to create artificial gravity by just spinning you around. So the amount of gravity that you get is equal to R times omega squared. And that means that you multiply the radius of the space station by the speed in RPM of how fast you're spinning squared. And that tells you how much gravity you would get. As R increases, gravity is going to go up. Or as you spin, it's going to go up even faster because it's omega squared. So if you can calculate whatever gravity level you want, and then figure out which spin rate you want, and that'll tell you how big your space station's got to be.
So the math checks out, and it seems quite simple on paper, but when you go to actually develop the hardware, what challenges are there, you know, moving forward in actually designing something this and putting it into orbit and making it work the way you want it to?
So there are challenges in doing this. On one end of the scale, if you make the size of the space station too small, then there are all kinds of interesting physiological things that happen due to things like Coriolis force. Because if you're in the spinning coordinate frame, as things move up and down the axis of the spin, they have this pseudo force that applies perpendicular to the range of motion. So the Russians tried to do this with a giant centrifuge, and they put some people inside this thing spinning in this huge centrifuge to do this on Earth. And there's great video that you can find if you go really down into deep holes and, you know, on YouTube or something. But you can see them playing darts where they throw the dart straight ahead, but they're hitting a target that's on the left wall. So they're throwing it, but then its path curves and they hit and they get good at it, and they were hitting bullseyes. But weird things happen if your radius is too small. And then other things like gravity gradient, where there's more gravity at your feet than at your head. So as you pick something up, it gradually becomes lighter. There's all these interesting effects that you can overcome by just simply making it big enough. So that's one. So if you make it too small, that's one problem. If you make it too big, then you have engineering problems, because then you have to have a really huge space station, which takes a lot of mass to orbit. If you're trying to spin, you can get something that big. You can get some interesting dynamics, and attitude control becomes so. So there's engineering challenges on the big side, and then there's human body challenges on the small side.
But, you know, if you're able to overcome this, as you mentioned, there are a lot of physiological effects that microgravity have on the human body when you're in space for extended period of time. The last time we spoke was about a commercial crew, a private crew going into space with Inspiration 4. I'm assuming that if you are able to get this technology to work the way you want to, this opens up the door for a lot more people to go to space, right? Is that the end goal, is to make these habitats more habitable for the everyday person going to space?
Yeah, it's. I think that's a good way of putting it. Ultimately, if you have even just, we hope even just a little bit of gravity would be enough to keep you a lot more healthy over a very extended stay in space. Once you start talking about years in space instead of just months, then, not only the bone and the muscle, but all these other things. And not only that, but there's practical considerations too. It's wonderful that if you put something down, that it will stay there. You know, I can't tell you how many things I lost on the space station because you can't put anything down. And not only that, you can't use two hands if you have to hold something. So we take it for granted, but gravity, and I won't even get into some of the more personal hygiene operations. So gravity can be a tremendous assistant. And I think that is, and also from the scientific perspective, getting data between zero and one, which we can do with controlled experiments using the vast space stations, would be very, very enlightening and really important, because right now we're taking a shot in the dark. If we send people to the moon, which roughly 1/6 Earth's gravity, we can hope that some of these problems will be solved, but we won't know until they come back or they live up there for months at a time. So we just got to go and try it. We have no data to say, you know, what to expect. So there's a lot of unknowns right now, and by doing this with in low Earth orbit with space stations, we can learn a lot more before we try to do this for really extended periods of time.
And Garrett, finally, before I let you go, what's the next step for VAST? What can we expect in the short term?
So in the short term, they're doing something very smart, which is they're keeping it simple. This is one of our big secrets to our success at SpaceX, which was, we didn't try to, make things overly complicated. And that's why, you know, we were able to do everything we did with the Falcon 9 and Dragon, is in general, simplicity, when you're trying to make things more reliable, more safe, more economical, more sustainable, and also higher performing, you usually can pick two, right? It's really hard to do all three. But the common enemy to all three of those things is complexity. So if you avoid complexity, You can do all three of those things simultaneously, and that's what VAST is doing with Haven 1, which will be the first private space station in Earth orbit. And the reason they're able to get it there first is because they're not trying to do too much, and it will be capable of hosting four crew members for up to 30 days at a time. It'll have a really cool window, and I think that's going to be the first step, and then we get into the big space stations that spin and all that really fun stuff.
We've been speaking with Garrett Reisman. He is a former NASA astronaut, amongst other things, and also the human spaceflight advisor at VAST. Garrett, thanks so much for sharing your insight with us.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Brendan. Good luck. Have fun down there.
That was Garrett Reisman, veteran NASA astronaut and advisor at VAST. Still to come, in astronomy, bigger is better. What the Giant Magellan Telescope might see when it comes online. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. A new ground-based telescope so large it may one day snap an image of a planet outside our own solar system. But to do that, scientists will need a really, really big telescope. Work has already begun on the Giant Magellan Telescope. We're here to talk about that development and what it could show us with its massive mirrors is Rebecca Bernstein, Chief Scientist for the Giant Magellan Telescope Organization. Well, Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. It's good to be here.
So let's start with just describing the structure of this telescope. I mean, it's already in the name. It's giant. Just how giant is it? And why is it that big?
So GMT is a 25-meter diameter telescope. We're building it in Chile. And the reason it's that big is because with a telescope that works at any wavelength, but particularly at optical and infrared wavelengths, the amount, the diameter of the telescope determines how much light you can collect, how fast, and it also determines the limiting spatial resolution of the telescope. So the name of the game in astronomy is to collect more light, to get more sensitivity and more spatial resolution so we can see what we're trying to study. So when it's complete, GMT is going to be 3 times larger than any existing telescope on the ground. It's going to be 4 times larger than JWST. And it's going to use 7 of the largest mirrors that can be made anywhere in the world in order to do that. The mirrors are made at the University of Arizona, which is one of our partners. The University of Arizona has a mirror lab where they make these. And it will also use a technology called deformable mirrors and a technique called adaptive optics to correct distortions in the atmosphere so that we can actually get to the full resolution of the telescope, which is going to be 4 times better than what you can get with JWST. So just to give you sort of a visceral sense of what that's going to mean for science and for what we can actually see and observe, remember the leap in how sharp images look and how bright they were, that leap between HST and JWST was from going from a 2.5 meter to a 6.5 meter telescope. So we're going to make a similar leap in resolution and sensitivity with the Giant Magellan Telescope relative to JWST. So that's why these larger telescopes are so important. They really let you measure and see much more in the universe.
I was going to say, when you start to wrap your head around the size of something like JWST and then give me that comparison between JWST and the Giant Magellan Telescope, that's huge.
Yes, and that's a really good example of why ground-based telescopes are so important, because you can build them much, much larger than you can build space telescopes. So we're still limited with space telescopes by the size of a telescope that we can launch, whereas from the ground, now with the combination of being able to build much larger telescopes and adaptive optics, we are really getting to an ability where we can do amazing things from the ground and are extremely complementary with what you can do from space, better in some ways. JWST is particularly designed to work in the infrared, which is a unique niche that you can do from space much better than you can do it from the ground. So JWST has capabilities in the infrared that we complement at optical and near-infrared wavelengths to do things they can't do. And it's really that combination that's going to be spectacular for science. The other really interesting thing about being from the ground is that you can constantly update them with the newest techniques and newest technology, like new detectors, new ways of manipulating the light to make different measurements. And that keeps ground-based telescopes really at the cutting edge throughout their lifetimes, which for the Giant Magellan Telescope is going to be about 50 years. So they're exceptionally powerful.
Yeah, and they need to be, because as you mentioned at the start of the conversation, the amount of light that you collect is, I mean, that's the name of the game when it comes to these astronomical observations, right? But also, what about the physical location? You mentioned that this is going to be in Chile. What advantages does that give the telescope and those using it?
Yeah, so there are a couple more things. You mentioned one, which is the location in Chile. So there are a few locations on Earth that are really ideal for observing the sky. And those are all going to be at high altitude, so they can get above a lot of the atmosphere. They're all going to be on the western edge of a continent. And that's because the atmosphere gets very smooth and laminar flowing over an ocean, whereas when the atmosphere is flowing over land, it gets very turbulent, disruptive. And you can sort of think of the heat coming off of a dark, you know, a blacktop off of a road in the summer. You see turbulence, and when you look across that road, you see wiggling in the background. That's atmospheric turbulence. We have new techniques that correct that. But still, you want to be at the western edge of a continent to minimize that effect. So you want to be at high altitude on the western edge of a continent, or an island works as well, but they're usually not as high altitude and not as dry. And that's the third thing. You want the location to be very dry so that you don't have clouds. So you want western, high altitude, desert, Chile. Chile, the Atacama Desert in Chile is the ideal location for ground-based telescopes. And that is where we are building GMT, the Giant Magellan Telescope.
The study of exoplanets is fascinating to me. We've had some telescopes out there. You've got Kepler, you've got TESS that are finding the signatures. JWST is actually looking at the atmospheric signatures of these exoplanets. I mean, what is the GMT going to add to the conversation? What will you be seeing when it comes to these exoplanets and hope to see?
That is an excellent question. So let me just remind you first that JWST is designed specifically, it was launched to work at infrared wavelengths. It was designed specifically to work at infrared wavelengths, and it was launched to be at a location in space where it doesn't even have the background light of the Earth itself, the background thermal emission of the Earth itself, so it's far away from Earth. That makes it uniquely able to study objects in the infrared. What is bright in the infrared? It's dusty things that are radiating from the dust or obscured by dust, hot things, and very high, very, very distant things. So things that are what we call redshifted by the cosmic expansion. What they're not good at is, what JWST is not going to be good at, is studying cooler planets. So remember, what does Earth look like? Earth looks like that beautiful blue marble as seen from the moon, right? It's not radiating its own light. It's reflecting the light of its parent star, our sun. So if you want to be able to study things that are not hot, you need to be able to look at visible light wavelengths. And so JWST is studying right now hot planets that have just formed, that are still young around their parent stars. But if we want to study the full range of planets throughout their evolution and really understand what the distribution of exoplanets is out there, then we need to be able to study them at visible light wavelengths. And GMT, the Giant Magellan Telescope, will be able to do that with a range of spectrographs and cameras that have some unique capabilities. So one thing we'll be able to do is measure the mass of Earth-sized planets around stars like our sun to understand their composition, to study their atmospheres, and eventually to understand if any of them host life. We'll be able to study specifically their composition to understand whether they're rocky or gaseous. We can, as you've already mentioned, study the atmospheres of those planets, but this time it's the atmospheres of cool planets in complementing what JWST can do in studying hotter planets. And really, those are the ones that are going to be potentially habitable. So there's a lot of excitement to really expand the range that you can do currently. And I just want to emphasize, this is incredibly hard stuff to do. So you just can't do it currently. And it really requires these next generation of telescopes to enable us to just have the tools that let us make these kinds of measurements. We need to be able to collect light, get that sensitivity. We need to be able to make sharp images. And we need to be able to put that basic capability of the telescope together with the ability to manipulate the light to make measurements. And I can give you some examples of what those measurements are. It's really sort of amazing. So one thing that we need to be able to do to figure out the masses and composition of the planets and study their atmospheres, all of that is to be able to take very high spectral resolution, separate the light into a very fine rainbow at visible wavelengths so that we can, among other things, measure the motion of planets around their parent stars. And the kind of motions we're talking about are 10 centimeters per second. So that's the speed of a turtle walking in the desert, right? Desert turtle strolling across the desert. We can measure that speed of a planet moving relative to its parent star. We can also use very high spatial resolution imaging cameras that actually take a picture of a planet orbiting a parent star. This is something that really has not been done. We have images of planets in emitted light in their thermal emission. So that's what JWST is doing now. That's what ground-based telescopes have done now. But we have not been able to take direct imaging of planets in reflected light. So remember, Earth is seen in the reflected light of its parent star. That's what we want to be able to do to study the full range of planets that are out there, including those cool planets. And also be able to detect the when we're taking spectra of them, be able to measure the combinations of molecules that can potentially tell us whether there's life on that planet.
So you're telling me that when this thing comes online, we might possibly get an image of a planet outside our own solar system, which has that ever been done before?
Well, we've taken images of planets in thermal emission. So that's the light that they emit as they're still cooling shortly after they form. But if we want to take images of older planets that can potentially host life, so we can better understand their atmospheres, so that we can better take those spectra that let us really measure the molecules in their atmospheres. We want to do that. We need a next generation of telescopes, specifically the Giant Magellan Telescope, paired with some of its instruments in order to be able to take those images.
Well, that's incredible. I'm super excited, and I want these images right now, but I know that that's not possible. So when is this coming online, and what work still needs to be done before we can make or get these images?
Okay, so right now, we're in construction on many of the components of the telescope and in final design on others. The structure that supports the glass, so we call it the mount of the telescope that holds the mirror that looks up at the sky, that mount is in construction in Illinois. The mirrors, as I've already mentioned, these seven beautiful mirrors that are the largest mirrors that have ever been made, they're being... Three of them are already complete and perfect and have been accepted for work for operation on the telescope. And three more have already been cast and are in various states of processing. The last one, the last seventh mirror, is going to be cast this fall. I already said we've already dug the foundation at the site in Chile. We're ready to pour concrete. And I mentioned we're in a combination of these construction aspects and in the final design, but we've already passed some major design reviews, in particular with the National Science Foundation. And our goal is to work with the National Science Foundation to become the largest public-private research facility ever undertaken. So, and we're in the middle of their process of reviews to make that possible. So we expect that this telescope will come online sometime early in the next decade. And we hope to be at that time working with the NSF to make this possible.
Well, Rebecca, I hope you come back to the show and keep us in the loop on the development of this. Very excited. Thank you so much for sharing the future of the Giant Magellan Telescope.
My pleasure.
That was Rebecca Bernstein, Chief Scientist for the Giant Magellan Telescope Organization. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit WMFE.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.